Guys, good morning, brothers. So it's good to be here, and I feel a little bit out of my league. I look around and see how long, you know, some of you guys have walked this walk, and so I feel like, we're almost the same age, but I'm a little bit younger, you know. So I feel humbled to be up here. So you guys can tell me. Someone told me they're going to be grading me after I'm done. So I, you know, they hold up little signs, and I wondered immediately what the Russian judge would give. So Sebastian, that's you, right? So you can be tough on me now, all right? So. I didn't know. I try not to look. Yeah, there you go. You see? So I paid them handsomely as well. So. All right, well, good. Well, first off, we're talking this morning. I've been asked to say just a couple of things, can't say everything, about what it means to be men of love. So I want to make a few points which... hopefully they can sort of call back to mind something that we've heard before. But also too, I guess part of being here for me is also this sense of being strengthened. You know what I mean? It's just being in the presence, as Father would say, it's sort of the encouragement. And that's what like confirmation means, right? I mean, remember when Christ says to Peter, I want you to turn and strengthen your brothers, to confirm your brothers in the faith, is actually in the Latin, confirmando. You think of confirmation to become strengthened. So I think that's kind of a little bit what these truths can do for us. So, and of course the world proposes, suggests to us certain notions of love. And as we look around, I think I was kind of thinking of different, you know, certainly pleasure, you know, might be there. Maybe sort of some kind of ego satisfaction, you know, I mean, whatever it might be. But a lot of it boils down to me satisfying my own desires. Right, that's oftentimes what sort of love comes to is I love this, right? So I'm going to sort of satisfy my desires, and we can get trapped if this is the only way we think about love. Okay, now this gets more complex. I don't want to say satisfying our desires or not, because we do desire God, right? We're made to desire God. You've made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you, says Saint Augustine. So there can be something good here, but. We can also get trapped in, and you see this sometimes happen, especially around people who are kind of just coming to faith. They begin to think about love in the same way that the world thinks about love, and they transfer it to God, and it becomes, what's God going to do for me today, right? What is he going to do for me today? And in a way that, okay, God does things for us, so there's not, but at some point we have to make this shift. And I was talking with my son about, he's got to do some speeches at KA, at Koinonia, and we were looking through classic sort of speeches, and we pulled up John F. Kennedy's inaugural address. You remember the famous line from John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Famous lines, right? And there's a certain nobility of spirit there, and it's a fundamental paradigm shift that JFK wanted, right? Now that's on the secular, that's sort of on the political side, whatever, fine, great, how to be good citizens. But a similar sort of paradigm shift, right? What can God do for me? What's he gonna do for me today? I think we have to make that sort of shift and be open to a different kind of love. And I wanna talk about that different kind of love other than desire satisfaction, okay? So I wanna kind of leave that a little bit to the side. And I would start, if I could point you anywhere, it would be Romans 5:5. I would love to be able to, and I hope one day to write something on various Bible verses that change the history of the world. Alan, you can't take my idea. But one of those would be Romans 5:5. So I'll just read this to you because I think, I mean, this is a really profound, and it really has this single verse. It's how the church has reflected on this verse throughout, all right? So Romans 5:5 reads this. It says, and it begins in the middle of a sentence. I'll just start in 3 where the sentence starts. More than that, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that the suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. Right? He's talked about faith. He moves into talking about hope. And then number 5, verse 5, he says, and hope does not disappoint us. Why? Here it is. Because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. there's this link between what God has done first and foremost in giving us the Holy Spirit, His own presence, as well as this gift of love that we have. So the presence of God in us, sanctifying grace, we might say, living in grace, is linked to this kind of love. And it's a love not of desire satisfaction, but of something God has poured out into us. And what it becomes is this sort of love becomes the way that we ourselves can love God, and we can love our neighbor in God, as a child of God, as a son or daughter of God, even if they are and they declare themselves to be our enemies. And so I want to talk a little bit, I'm going to rip some pages out of, surprise, surprise, Sebastian, St. Thomas Aquinas. He's sort of the guy I like. He's what we call the common doctor. He's the perennial flower. I know I'm talking to a group of guys, but you know what perennials are, right? You know what perennials are probably for the same reason I do. When my wife says, hey, I want to get some flowers to put around the house, I start thinking money. And she says, how about this one? I say, well, that's an annual. That means I got to go back and buy it next year. Let's get this one, because it just keeps flowering. So St. Thomas Aquinas is the common doctor, the perennial flower in the garden of the church. So I want to rip out some pages and talk about this sort of love that's been poured out into our hearts. And it is the what we call the virtue, or the theological virtue, of love or charity, right? Faith, hope, and charity. And the greatest of these is love, right? Says 1 Corinthians 13. Okay, so what are three things? First, I want to name three things about this love, and then I want to link it to a couple of things outside of that love, link it to a little bit, okay? Then I'm done, I promise, I'll stop. The first thing that this love, that this caritas, this sort of, right? I call it in Latin caritas because I'm a little bit of a snob academically. But besides that, we confuse charity with giving money, and we confuse love with pizza and wine and sports cars. You know what I mean? So I like to just remove it and just say we're talking about caritas. We're talking about this love that's been poured out into our hearts by God in grace. The first thing he says is, and he uses the word benevolence. But if you think about this word, right? If you remember your Latin, benevolere, to will the good, is simply what it is, right? It is to will the good. So notice the fundamental difference then between this sort of love where I want to consume something, right? I love coffee cake. I inhale it, right? I love good, you know, Chardonnay. Okay, whatever it might be. I love this and I want to consume it. My desire satisfaction model, right? And this other love, which first and foremost is marked off by my willing the good for that which I love. Does that make sense? There's the fundamental paradigm shift. Right? And so what we're talking about is a love that wills the good for the other and is not just caught up with what it can do for me, but to use the John F. Kennedy paradigm shift, what I can do or how I can serve. Okay, so that's the first fundamental thing. I was reading recently with my son, The Lord of the Rings. And if any of you are familiar with Tolkien, wonderful Catholic, right, author, he talks, if you know the story, you've seen the movies, there's this ring. And everybody wants to possess the ring to the point that it possesses them. Does that make sense? That's that desire possession. And the evilness of this ring is that it actually takes people over and it starts to feed on this craving, and they want to take. And the true heroes in the story are the ones who can give, who can sacrifice, who can will the good in the face of that. It's a fundamental play between these two loves in a way. So I'm here to will the good for the other. But this willing the good for the other, the second thing that we can imagine is this is not, as we oftentimes hear, it's not an emotion. Right? It's an emotion. I have a wonderful quote. I love this from St. Thomas, just to give us a sort of stark, non-emotive language that he uses. Quote, he says, "It is by the sole judgment of reason that one man wills the good of another. It is by the sole judgment of reason that I choose to do this." So it's not an emotion, this sort of benevolence, but it does require that I see the good in the other. And I thought of this when we were talking a little bit about last week's talk, right? Men of purity, what did it become? It became about you will see God. That's the promise of the Beatitude. When we're pure of heart, when we're single-minded of purpose, we can see the good in the other. And sometimes even when nobody else can see the good in the other, right? Gosh, I'd love this one quote. Do I have time? Is it okay if I say one more thing? Because then I'm going to go to my second point. Again, Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton. He talks, everyone knows the story of the Beauty and the Beast. He says, wonderful reflection on the Beauty and the Beast, where he says, the Beauty and the Beast is a story that shows us a fundamental reality of life, that we must first love something before it is lovable. Right? Now Chesterton's always sort of this apostle of paradox, right? But what Belle does in that fable, Belle sees something in the Beast that nobody else sees. She sees what's good, and she can call, and her love, in a certain sense, calls it out, right? And he begins to transform. Anyway, okay, blah, blah, blah. Benevolence, the first mark. The second mark, Aquinas, and I'm going to be a Latin snob again, he calls it communicatio. Now, it's easy. You slap an N on it, and it's communication, right? And it's underwhelming, because you're like, communication? You mean I got to, like, communicate? Like, sit down, how are you feeling? And I'm feeling, no, this isn't what he's talking about. It's not what he's talking about, right? A communicatio is a sharing or a partaking of life. We share life together. Now, I missed it, but one of the other talks, and I'm trying to think about this, you know, is to be men of prayer. But this is exactly why we're talking about, if we're going to be men of love, we have to be men of prayer. Because we have to share a life with God, right? If first and foremost, we have to place God in the first place, but we also have to share a life and share our life with those that we're actually supposed to be sharing life with. Right? So there's a partaking, a certain kind of reciprocity, a common life that bonds us together. Not only is this attached to prayer, but this is the wisdom of the precept of the church that says every Sunday there's an obligation to go to Mass. Why? Because for those of us who share the faith, as a minimum, we need to be together. As a minimum. And daily Mass all the better. Right? And it's a precept. It's not supposed to be a have to. If we see the point of the law, it's supposed to be, this is what sets me free, right? Okay, so the second thing is this communicatio, and I'll say one last thing about it. This is so serious in the Christian life, and sometimes we only get how serious it is by looking at its opposite, ex communicatio. You see? To be cut off. And that's what we mean by excommunication. It's actually directly related to whether we're living this common life together or we've cut ourselves off. So it's quite a serious thing, this note of communicatio, communication, sharing of life. So benevolence, to will the good of the other, to partake and share a life together, number two. But number three, says Aquinas, to have this sort of caritas, to have this divine gift of love, it means to have some kind of mutuality or reciprocity. It's not the same, like, you know, if I'm a Seahawk fan. Right? So I love Russell Wilson. No, I don't. I might admire Russell Wilson, right? And who knows? Maybe Russell Wilson is a secret admirer of mine. Maybe, Sean, who knows? Maybe those talks, I mean, they're out there, right? No, okay. But even if he was, it's not that far-fetched, is it? even if he was, right? I'm an admirer of him, he's an admirer of me, but there's no real reciprocity there. There's no real friendship, right? So this reciprocity, this sort of, it has to be reciprocal, it has to sort of call forth something and be an actual relationship, right? And so where there's no reciprocity, there is no sense of love. There might be admiration, but there's no sense of love. Okay, so these three things, to will the good, to share a common life, and that common life has a certain sense of reciprocity, a certain sense of, we would say in theology, a divine exchange, right? And this happens, Father could tell us, in the liturgy. What do? We bring our gifts of bread and wine, our poor gifts. Like the story in the gospel of the boy who brings his loaves and fishes. So what's good? What good is this, right? And God transforms that and gives it back as himself, right? So there is, even in the liturgy, this divine reciprocity. And that brings me to something, so those are my three points on this love. I want to just make a couple quick points as well that this sort of love attaches to. And the first thing is, I want to attach it to the sacrament of charity, right? Because we call the Eucharist, one of its nicknames, we like to nickname things in the church, you know that? I like that. The doctor of grace, the angelic doctor, right? The seraphic doctor. And you can go through, you can name saints, you can name all sorts of things. The bread of angels. We have all sorts of beautiful ways to call out different aspects of the same reality, because these realities are above us. And we need different ways to look at them. But the Eucharist is called the sacrament of charity, right? The sacrament of caritas, of this love. Because in it, we see all of these marks, right? In it, we see all of these marks. We see benevolence. We see Christ willing the good, our salvation, to the point of sacrifice, even sort of immolation of himself upon the cross. And notice how different that willing the good is. Sacrifice is a live option. If you buy into this form of love, if you're buying into the desire satisfaction, what are you going to do for me? How do you lay down your life in that model? Right? Because there's got to be a me left here. So come on, like, I'm not going to, all right? What was that old movie? They had an old movie where the, you know, they're walking around. I think it was, I don't know, it was a Robin Williams, one of these comedy army movies. And he goes, he's introducing a new guy into the battalion. He goes, any guy in here would take a bullet for you. And one of the guys goes, not in the chest though, right? No, not in the chest, in the arm. Yeah, you know. So he's like, right, don't ask that much, right? Don't ask that much, right? I got to be around still to get my desires, to get my part, right? But when you talk about this laying down our lives and men of service, men of love, this is what we mean, is to will the good, even to the point of martyrdom, right? And so we see this in Christ. In the Eucharist, right? This sacrifice. No greater love has one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends, in John 15:13. So we also see this communication. Did you know, I mean, in the old Catholic way of speaking about receiving communion, we talked about communicating, right? We've got this sort of modern way of going, well, did you receive communion today? Right, or receive communion. We got to get these two words in. We used to say, did you communicate? Interesting, right? This is how I receive the Lord in communion, is I communicated, and this is really what it was a sharing of life. Not just him sharing with me, but me sharing with him, full active participation. And this, of course, reciprocity. Not only do I give of myself to Christ in liturgy, but I'm called to then be this, to carry this living witness out into the world, out into the church, out into my family, right? To be an imitator of Christ, to lay down our lives for our brides, for our wives, for our families, for those around us, certainly for those who are married, right? And so you get these sort of moments where I remember when I was first married, my wife Delphine, we had one of our first sort of, you know, first year lover tiffs, you know, after we're married and stuff, and we didn't have a big apartment, so it was really hard to like run away. Right, you know, it was pretty much the bedroom, the bathroom, the kitchen, the dining room, the living room, and the kitchen, dining room, living room, it was like, you know, 20 feet, right? So she's in the kitchen, I'm in the living room, we're as far away as we can get from each other, and we're just kind of, and I said to myself, okay, if you're going to be the man here, you have to cross the room first, right? You got to be the first one to take the step out of this stubbornness, because we're, you know, maybe we're both being a little stubborn here. And be able to say, let's restart here, right? Let's restart and let's talk through this and, you know, and whatnot. So I think of that oftentimes in my life. Am I going to be that phrase sticks with me, right? Sort of the Holy Spirit pings me. First one to cross the room? ? Oh, okay, fine. You know, so, all right. So that's the first thing I would link this sort of love to is the sacrament of the Holy Eucharist. The second thing that we can sort of link it to, I want to go negative, sorry, we've been positive, is it's a sin in our lives that we oftentimes probably don't think about today very much. And we don't think about it in the ways that the saints thought about it. We have a tradition called the capital sins, right? And you've heard of these things. Now, capital sins come out of the Desert Fathers from St. Leo the Great, St. Gregory the Great, and through the sort of these great medieval minds and into the church's tradition, right? So we'll hear someone like St. Thomas Aquinas picking this up and talking about it. You can read St. Gregory the Great preaching about it. But these seven capital sins, the reason they're called capital sins is because these sins are like commanders of an entire army that's coming in behind them. In other words, these sins, if we let these sins break in to us, right, then they're going to be coming with certain children. The capital sins lead to other sins. That's why they're called capital. Does that make sense? And in that way, they're different than not every, I don't want to say that. This is very moral theology for, what are we, 7:30? You can talk about mortal sins, and that's a wider group of things than the seven capital sins. The seven capital sins mean you let these guys in and watch out, right? Into the breach sort of comes this army behind them. One of the seven capital sins is sloth. We don't think a lot about sloth, probably because we're very productive people. We're in a culture that prides itself on being productive. Right? And what do you think of when you think of sloth? You think of the guy who's, right, sitting on the sofa, feet up, eating, probably me on Sunday, eating the chips, right? And never gets going, right? You kind of think of this as, if you're like me, that's how you think about sloth. That's not how St. Thomas Aquinas, that's not how this entire tradition of saints thought about it. The way that they thought about sloth was a loss in your spiritual joy, the loss of the spiritual good. A wonderful author, if you ever want to read a wonderful Catholic author that's sometimes overlooked, is Joseph Pieper. Joseph Pieper writes about sloth under its Latin name, Asadia, is what it was called. And he talks about that in our workaholic age today, it is quite possible, it is a realistic possibility that the workaholic is actually guilty of sloth. Because the workaholic may be so distracted with what's going on here that he's forgotten his spiritual good. He's forgotten the joy of the love of God. Does that make sense? That is actually guilty of sloth. So sloth isn't just laziness, it could be laziness. But it might be the person that's so distracted, I don't have time for that. Does that make sense? Okay. So there's a wonderful book out called The Noonday Devil, wonderful spiritual reading from a French abbot. It's called The Noonday Devil, and it's about this sin of asadia, of sloth in our lives, right? Father Dennis from the Shrine had recommended it to me. Was that too revelatory, self-revelatory? Anyway, but I think there's a point here. Why is it called the Noonday Devil in the Desert Fathers? Because this is the sin that sneaks into our life when we're just in the middle of life, kind of going through the motions. We can begin to lose that flame. Does that make sense? Okay. How am I doing on time? Okay, I have no idea what time is. So we talk about its link. We talk about caritas and being men of caritas linked to the sacrament of the Holy Eucharist. We talk about the danger of sloth. It steals our joy. It steals our spiritual good, which this love is supposed to inflame. And that's why when Aquinas is thinking about sloth, he shows it to be the opposite, to be one of those sins that destroys this love of God that God's poured out into our hearts. Does that make sense? By the way, envy is the other one. Because when I'm slothful, I lose the joy of my own salvation. Right? I lose the joy that I find in God. When I'm envious, I destroy the joy that I should have for my neighbor, for my neighbor's good. Because I want, right? Okay. Last point, that we can link this caritas, this love, to be men of love to. And that is the opposite of sloth, joy. Right? Joy is one of the fruits of this life of love, of being men of love. And I think for me, when I think about Pope Francis, Father and I were sort of rapping about this last week here during, where we're drinking some coffee, we're talking about, like, I think for me, the witness that Pope Francis gives us in the church, if I ask for one thing that I find him to be a gift to me for, it is that sense of joy of the gospel. That to me is the essence, if I had to put my finger on anything, you know what I mean? They oftentimes say, watch the first encyclical of a pope, because it will generally indicate to you sort of a very strong theme that pope, the one thing he wants, if I die tomorrow, I got to say this, right? So what was John Paul II's? It was called Redemptoris Hominis, the Redeemer of Man. It was this idea that Christ actually shows us what it is to be a fully alive human person, right? And everyone's looking for their true selves, the best version of their self. And John Paul II comes along and says, that's in Jesus Christ, right? So Pope Francis, he double wrote one with Pope Benedict, so I'm not counting that one, but it's the joy of the gospel, right? That's his first thing he wants to say to us. And I want to read you something, if I can bore you, for just the last few minutes. I want to read you something from Pope Benedict. And he wrote this as a cardinal just before he was elected to be Pope Benedict. He was asked by a secular atheist, Marcello Pera was his name, and he was the president of the Senate in Italy, declared self-atheist, and he found himself, but this is just a little backstory, Marcello Pera gave a speech in Rome one day, and then Cardinal Ratzinger gave a speech in Rome one day, and they both showed up in various publications the next morning. Marcello's looking at his speech, and he's like, this is like the same speech. And I'm an atheist. And he's the head of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith that talks about, like, what's it? So he writes him a letter, and they start this wonderful dialogue. This is published, by the way, I'm really not trying to sell books. This is published by Ignatius Press called Without Roots. It's beautiful. It's a reflection on sort of the state of Christianity today, especially in Europe. But it's enlightening. This is what Pope Benedict, then Cardinal Ratzinger, wrote back about why is the faith failing today? And he talks about it particularly in Europe, but many of the things I think make sense to us here as well in America. He says this. This is Cardinal Ratzinger. The question of why the Christian faith today is struggling to convey its great message to people in Europe inevitably regards the believing Christian and above all the pastor of the church. I see two main reasons for its difficulties. Why is the church failing? Here comes Benedict, right? Wonderful mind. He says two main reasons. I'm not going to give you the second one. That was faith and reason. But here's his first reason. Here's the first one, he says. The first reason was articulated by Nietzsche. Friedrich Nietzsche, for those of you who don't read as much philosophy as you would like. To summarize it, Friedrich Nietzsche's philosophy could be seen as the ideal for Adolf Hitler. Let me just put it that way. Okay, not good. He says interesting things, but in general, not good. Okay, but this is what Nietzsche says. The first reason was articulated by Nietzsche when he wrote, now here's Nietzsche, here's the Pope quoting Nietzsche, okay? So Nietzsche's gonna say how to destroy Christianity. Ready? Christianity has thus far always been attacked in the wrong way, says Nietzsche. As long as one does not perceive Christian morality as a capital crime against life, its defenders will always have it easy. The question of the truth of Christianity is something entirely secondary as long as the question of the value of Christian morality is not addressed. What's Nietzsche saying? That's the end of the quote. Nietzsche says, if you want to attack the Christian, don't go after the articles of faith. Don't go after what they believe, because they're going to come and they're always going to be able to defend that. They're very good at that. Don't do that. If you want to destroy Christianity, show that the way of life is not joyful, that it's sucking life out of you, that you're missing things in the world and everything else, and that it's just nothing but a big pain and obligation. If you can get that into people's minds, then you'll destroy Christianity. Cardinal Ratzinger reads this in Nietzsche and says, that's precisely our problem. So then he continues. This is now Cardinal Ratzinger. Here, what we are actually addressing, in my opinion, is the decisive reason for the abandonment of Christianity. Its model for life is apparently unconvincing. It seems to place too many restraints on humankind that stifle the joie de vivre, right? That joy of life, right? Christianity seemed to stifle that joy. That limits its precious freedom, and that do not lead to an open pastures, in the language of the Psalms, but rather want and deprivation. He goes on to say, and he literally says the words, the answer to this is the joy of the gospel. So I love Pope Francis. He's sort of bringing this to the fore, but it's already hidden as the principal reason why the Christian faith isn't compelling, because people have taken up this idea that it's just a bunch of obligations. If I do that, I'm going to have to, desire satisfaction, you hear it? I have to do all of this sort of thing. But what does Christ say? right? If you verily, verily, truly, truly, I say to you, if unless a grain of wheat fall and die, it remains a grain of wheat.
But if it does, right? If we sort of go this way of giving of self,
it becomes multiple, right? I'll leave you with this. This is a quote about joy as well. If any of you have read G.K. Chesterton's book on orthodoxy, promise is my last endorsement. This is how he ends the book on orthodoxy. Man is more himself, man is more manlike, when joy is the fundamental thing in him, and grief the superficial. Melancholy should be an innocent interlude, a tender and fugitive frame of mind. Praise should be the permanent pulsation of the soul. So we sit, perhaps, in a starry chamber of silence, while the laughter of the heavens is too loud for us to hear. Joy, which was the small publicity of the pagan, is the gigantic secret of the Christian. This giving, this being men of love, not just desire satisfaction of sucking and trying to consume it, this is like, but to be this one who lays down his life is a joyful life as well. And this is the fundamental witness, according to Pope Benedict, that we can give to our faith today as well. All right? So, that's a lot of theology. You ready? Is that good? You're still awake? All right. Anyhow, good. How'd I do, Sebastian?
Pretty well.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. So, take care, guys.
I'm gonna change the review.
It was you!